doing today, Jeremy?
Well, how about you?
Doing really well. I want to thank you. The podcast that we did on the Israeli-Palestinian quote-unquote conflict is the most downloaded and the most listened to on YouTube of any episode I've ever done. And
that's great to hear.
Yeah, and I've people have told me, I've been told directly that people have listened to it 2 and 3 times. So we're educating, man. You're educating people, and I want to thank you for all that information, because I need to go back over that podcast and listen to it again too, so I can get everything.
There was a lot in there. There's a lot to unpack.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned on the last episode that you've been doing a lot of research on vaccines, and you know the schedule of vaccines for infants. I've read an article of yours where you talked about the flu vaccine, and one thing that I know about this subject from spending as much time on social media as I do, it's wild, man. This is a passion. People get insane over this. I mean, if you start questioning vaccines, you know, the people who are pro-vaccination they lose their shit. If you're anti-vaccination, I mean, those people can get really, you know, get intense. It seems like if you question it at all, if you not, and most of the time it's not even questioning the science. It's questioning the public policy that surrounds it. So,
right.
I know that you look at it from, I'm going to investigate and see exactly how much research, how many studies have been done. And you look for, and I saw, like, on your flu vaccine, you just saw whole swaths of the population that they just didn't, you know, that they didn't do any studies on. So how do you, when you talk to this to people, how do you get past that whole, you know, how can you question science kind of, you know, thing?
Yeah, that's a really important question, because, like you said, it's just such an emotionally intense issue. I mean, people have emotional reactions when you even bring it up. Whereas, you know, I try to approach it, let's approach it from just a rational, you know, level-headed basis. And the media actually prevents this from happening, because the way they frame the issue is that if you question public policy, you know, they have the derogatory label anti-vaxxer that they apply, and you know, anti-vaxxers, as we all know, are quote-unquote anti-science, and that's like the end-all, be-all of the discussion, that, you know, if you either are pro-science and support public policy, or you criticize public policy and don't follow the CDC schedule and are anti-science, and that's just no basis for a serious discussion. So, you know, I think a lot of people have this perception that, you know, what the CDC says is science, and it's science-based, and the CDC's recommendations are science-based. And the problem is that that's just not the case. And the reality is, as people who really seriously study this issue know, that, you know, what the government and the mainstream media say science says about vaccines and what science actually tells us about vaccines are two completely different things. And so that's, you know, what I'd like to do is just, like, let's just have a discussion about what the science actually says. And, you know, unfortunately, just given the environment, the atmosphere surrounding this issue, that's really hard to do. You know, like I said, the media doesn't, you know, there is a serious discussion to be had, and the media just isn't having it. And you know, I can give examples of that. You mentioned, you know, my recent flu shot report, doing a multi-part expose on the influenza vaccine. Actually, I was actually just working on part two, which I hope to get published tomorrow. You're referring to part one, which is already published. And, you know, this is a perfect example, because what I did is I just took a case study of a recent New York Times article by Aaron Carroll, where he's basically saying, you know, everyone needs to go out and follow the CDC's recommendations and get your annual flu shot. And, of course, he's saying, you know, science shows that the shot is effective and, you know, it confers a huge public health benefit on society. And that, you know, the evidence of harm from the vaccine are almost non-existent. His words, quote, almost non-existent. But, you know, it's interesting because he provided links to, you know, studies from the medical literature in his article to support his claims about what the science says. And anyone can go and read those studies and see what they actually say. And I'm not saying here that we shouldn't believe the study. I'm not saying, oh, well, you know, I'm not questioning the science here. What I'm questioning is the way the media presents the science. And what those studies actually say, you know, is there were he had very good sources, in fact, for the medical literature. He was citing the Cochrane Collaboration, which is a prestigious international organization that doesn't accept any industry funding, and they specialize in what's called meta-analyses. So a meta-analysis is basically like a thorough review of the medical literature where they go in. You know, they look at the body of available evidence and then make determinations based on not just individual studies, but the whole body of evidence. And so he was citing Cochrane Collaboration studies. And, you know, interestingly, the very study that he cited to support his characterization that science has vindicated the CDC's, you know, flu vaccine recommendation, that very study that he was citing, in fact, the authors of that study went so far in their criticism of the CDC's policy as to accuse the CDC of deliberately misrepresenting the science in order to support their policy. So that's how bad it gets when we're talking about how the media misrepresents the science. You know, here's just a clear case. You know, he cited a second Cochrane Collaboration study in that same article, you know, to support his claim that the evidence of harm is almost non-existent. Well, you can click that link and read that study and what the researchers from the Cochrane group actually concluded were that there's a woeful lack of safety studies with the influenza vaccine, particularly with children under two, which hasn't been studied at all. I think they said they found one randomized controlled study in children under two. Whereas the CDC recommends that vaccine for infants as young as 6 months. Where are the studies showing that that's safe? You know, and so it's easy to say that, you know, if the studies haven't been done, it's easy to say, well, there's no evidence of serious harms, but then don't characterize it as though the science has proven that when the studies haven't been done. You know, the Cochrane Collaboration has called, you know, urgently for studies to be done, randomized controlled studies to determine the safety of the influenza vaccine. Same thing with pregnant. CDC recommends the flu shot for pregnant women. Well, where are the studies showing that's a safe practice? The Cochrane Collaboration in 2014, another meta-analysis, found that the number of randomized controlled trials, you know, assessing the safety for both the expectant mother and the fetus with the influenza vaccine was zero. There are none. And that's acknowledged right on the manufacturer's vaccine, you know, product inserts for their influenza vaccines, where they state right in there that the studies have never been done to assess the safety of their product in pregnant women. So, yeah. And so they advise caution. Well, what does that mean in light of the CDC's recommendation that all pregnant women should get the flu shot? I mean, it's really insane. It's insane the way the media characterized this issue as though questioning public policy was, you know, tantamount to you're a loon. Like you're a tinfoil hat wearing conspiracy theorist to question, you know, the safety and efficacy, effectiveness of vaccines. That's insane. Like, let's have a real discussion here. Let's, like, really look at what the science says and have a discussion about it. And, you know, and I'm I appreciate this opportunity to do that with you. And I'm glad that there are people like you, you know, who help to get this information out there, because the media, the mainstream media, is just utterly failing.
Yeah.
Just, you know, and they're part of the problem. The mainstream media is part of the problem.
And they've done a good job of they do a really good job of giving out talking points, because exactly. the pro-vaccine people, you know, who are, you know, vaccine or nothing, they don't care. They don't want to know. They don't want to know what's in it. They're not going to read the insert. I mean, no one's reading that insert. They know immediately to bring up polio. They know immediately to bring, it's like gun control. They just have these sound bites that they throw out there to try and make you sound like a monster.
Right.
They have no, you know, when was the last time the media reported on a settlement from a vaccine injury? And they happen all the time. There's actually a vaccine court. And people don't know about these. People don't know about these things. There are people. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, that's really important. You know, people don't just people. That's the thing. People just don't understand how the system actually works. You know, they can't fathom that, you know, their doctor could be wrong, or, you know, the American Academy of Pediatrics could be wrong, and, you know, the CDC and the FDA and that the medical establishment can be wrong. But it's like, let's look at history, you know? I mean, it's not as though the medical establishment has proven infallible when we look at history. I mean, you can remember the time when, you know, I mean, I wasn't around at the time, but, you know, it wasn't that long ago that, you know, DDT is good for me. You remember those, you know, we've seen those old advertisements, propaganda. You know, doctors used to promote cigarettes.
Thalidomide.
Today, we're facing issues, you know, where doctors are still recommending, you know, replacing saturated fat with, you know, like vegetable oils and things. And even, you know, never mind the science that has shown that hypothesis that dietary cholesterol, you know, it was a risk factor for heart disease. Never mind that that's been completely, you know, debunked, you know, with more recent science. You know, there's this cognitive dissonance that exists. A lot of it has to do, I mean, you can read, there's medical literature about just how bad medical literature is, you know, how bad some of the science is. I mean, the studies showing.
Well, you know what's crazy is, I mean, it's almost become, if you talk about thalidomide, it's almost become like a punchline. It's almost something that, like, stand-up comics bring up in their routines. Or the fact that, yeah, you want to trust the government, yet the Tuskegee syphilis study was still going on in my lifetime. How do people not question? I mean, and that was given under the guise of free health care.
Right.
How do people not get this? Is it the white coat that they trust everything?
That's such a great question, and there's a lot of different angles to approach that question, but to me the biggest thing is what I like to call faith in what I call the state religion, which is a term I'm borrowing from Noam Chomsky, actually, who observed that, you know, intellectuals, public intellectuals, serve the role of manufacturing consent for public policy, and this is the role that the media play. And to me, when I say that, you know, there's just this faith in government, and I saw this, you know, before I was really got into the vaccine issue. Most of my work that I'm more well known for, like the Israel-Palestine conflict, is related to U.S. foreign policy. And, you know, I would just look into the question of how the media manufacture consent for foreign policy. And I think a lot of it has to do just with the sense that, you know, people can trust the government to tell them the truth. I ran into that with the Iraq War when I was writing about how the government was lying, you know, about the threat of weapons of mass destruction, and there was no evidence that Iraq still had, you know, stockpiles of WMD. At that time I was called a conspiracy theorist for saying that too, you know. Just no serious discussion about it. But I ran into that, you know, with my own, you know, family, friends, people I know who were just so resistant to that. Like, they couldn't, and even though I was showing them, I was, like, literally giving them the information, showing them that what the government says and what the reality is, you know, are the opposite truths, you know, are opposites of each other. And they just wouldn't, they just refuse to see it. And this is a psychological thing, I think, where, you know, people just don't, people have their worldview, and anything that threatens that worldview is, you know, they will tend to just reject. And anything that, you know, on the other hand, anything that supports that worldview, they will attach to and cling on to, no matter how, you know, unsubstantiated or unsupported it is, you know, in terms of factual evidentiary basis. So there's this kind of confirmation bias that people suffer from, and it's institutionalized. You know, it's institutionalized in the CDC. It's institutionalized in private organizations like the AAP or, you know, the American Academy of Pediatrics or American Medical Association. It's institutionalized naturally within the vaccine industry itself, in the pharmaceutical industry, where, you know, anything that the confirmation bias I'm referring to, or anything that, that, you know, supports public policy, you know, the CDC is going to latch on to, whereas anything that contradicts it, is just dismissed. A good example of that, I've just mentioned I'm working on part two of my influenza vaccine expose today. And one of the things that you'll learn in part two is how, you know, the CDC uses a marketing of fear, number one, to sell more flu shots. And one of the things that they do is they claim, I mean, one of the fundamental premises of their flu shot recommendation is that it will reduce mortality among the elderly. And so CDC has long claimed that that is true, that, that, you know, studies show that vaccination reduces deaths among, you know, people age 65 and older. Interestingly, what we've actually observed is that as vaccine rates in that age group have increased, that mortality has actually from influenza and pneumonia, which the CDC actually combines together, which we could talk about too, but the mortality has actually increased as the vaccine uptake has increased. And what the CDC has done to support this claim that, that the vaccine reduces mortality is it cites what are known as observational studies. So these are like retrospective studies, you know, examining, you know, like surveillance data or other data that it's not what you think of in terms of like it's like a forward looking prospective you know randomized placebo controlled type study. They're retrospective studies, observational studies, and the CDC has studied these kinds of studies. And the problem is some of the claims are just implausible. Like, for example, the CDC has claimed that the vaccine actually prevents death from all causes by half. So in case people that didn't quite understand what I meant, what the CDC is saying is that the vaccine not only prevents deaths from the flu, from the influenza virus, but from any cause, that, up to 50%.
That doesn't make any sense.
So scientists from the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, you know, kind of looked at that puzzled, thinking, well, we know that, you know, in any given year, on average, maybe 5%, no more than 10% of deaths are related to the influenza vaccine. To the influenza virus. We know that. So how can it be that half of deaths are preventable from any cause in a given flu season? I mean, it just didn't make any sense. So they looked deeper at the methodology of the studies that the CDC was relying on. And what they determined was that they all suffered fatally from systemic bias, that scientists call, it's called a healthy user bias. It's a type of selection bias. And in this particular case, the selection bias was that it wasn't that people who got the flu shot were less likely to die, but that people who were more likely to die were less likely to get a flu shot. So in one study that confirmed this bias, I mean, there were numerous, there was a series of studies, but one of the studies that confirmed that bias concluded that the effect of the bias was so great that it accounted for the entire perceived benefit of the vaccine. So what was CDC's response to that? Well, it ignored it. Actually, I shouldn't say it ignored it. It it criticized the 2005 study that I originally referred to with the NIH researchers. They published their findings. And so the CDC criticized their study for methodological flaws and maintained its faith in the studies that it was citing, the observational studies. Excuse me. So, again, there's that confirmation bias. You know, anything that supports their policy, they're going to latch onto. And whatever science debunks, it's what it's relying on, the CDC just ignores, pretends it doesn't exist. So that's just one clear example. And, to look further at the case of the flu shot, the CDC has justified its recommendation that we should all get a flu shot every year. Also on the assumption, the basis of the assumption that not only that it would reduce mortality among the elderly, but also that, it would, reduce transmission of the virus and result in fewer, potentially deadly complications. Well, the same Cochrane collaboration review that I mentioned earlier that the New York Times cited as, fully vindicating CDC policy, the same Cochrane review pointed out that actually, in its systematic review of the literature turned up no evidence to support either of those assumptions. And in fact, a study published just January this year actually bothered to look at the question of whether the vaccine prevents transmission, like the CDC claims, and found that, in fact, vaccinated individuals shed up to six times more aerosolized virus than people who didn't get a flu shot in this or the prior flu season. So the evidence actually indicates the opposite is true, that vaccination could actually increase viral transmission. And it's just like this across the board. When you look at the actual science and when you look at the actual studies and when you dig into the medical literature and read for yourself and think for yourself, this is what you find. And the unwillingness of mainstream journalists to look at this question seriously, anyone who's read anything from mainstream media about this, it's this, like you mentioned, it's the same talking points over and over and over again. Like, let's look at, the claim that vaccines are responsible for the reduction in communicable diseases throughout the 20th century. Let's look at that claim. Well, we can look at the rates of mortality, for example, of measles or pertussis or these other communicable diseases that were supposedly vaccines have saved us from. And what we find is that, well before the vaccine was even introduced, these rates were already plummeting. And there are studies that look, address that point, and they look at that question of how did we achieve these great gains in terms of reduction in mortality or morbidity from, these communicable diseases. Without the vaccine, before the vaccine even was introduced, there's answers to that question. It was advances in standard of living. We had improving knowledge of healthcare, better nutrition standards, sanitation, personal hygiene standards. These were all improving, and this is what accounts for the great majority of the reductions diseases that we saw. And that's not even controversial. It's not something that, it's just...
That's just statistics.
Just look at the data. Just look at it. Then there's this, another talking point is, the only thing that the media ever even looks at in terms of, potential harms from the vaccine, the only issue they ever touch is the question of autism. As though that was like the only thing that there is to talk about in terms of harms from vaccines. And there's all these, we don't even have to touch the question of whether vaccines can cause autism or not. Don't even have to go there. And yet there still remains just mountains and mountains of evidence indicating serious harms.
Well, let's do that. Let's do that. Okay. You've told me that, this became a great interest to you when you had a child. your wife gave birth. And
yeah.
So you started looking into this, and you told me that you've looked into this, the you know, especially the very early schedules, and you know, what are you finding that the specifically on the research that's, or the studies that are done before they even introduce these to the to the public, to children, to babies.
Well, yeah, that's, you know, people have this, again, this sense that kind of segues nicely from what I was saying earlier about, you know, people have this trust in the government, and they have this faith that, well, the FDA approved this thing, so therefore it must be safe. Of course, the FDA, you know, there's studies that are done to show that these things are safe. There's clinical trials. But people don't really understand actually how the FDA vaccine approval process works. And, you know, most drugs, they have, you know, they're required to do long-term randomized placebo-controlled studies. This actually isn't a requirement for vaccines. And in fact, vaccine studies, clinical trials that are done to gain FDA licensure for vaccines frequently use, they don't use placebos. And they frequently use, for example, other vaccines as a comparison group. So you have one, you know, group getting the vaccine that supposedly they're testing the safety of, and the comparison group is getting another vaccine. Well, that's not a test that can determine the safety of the vaccine, because it's gonna elevate the background rate of adverse events, you know, as compared to what would, you know, probably show up if they had used like an inert placebo. So that's one thing. You know, the FDA doesn't do any of its own studies. It doesn't rely on independent studies. All the studies that are done come from the vaccine manufacturers themselves, who of course have a financial incentive to bury any data that doesn't give them the result they're looking for, and to give the FDA whatever data that they can provide.
And just to interrupt you for a second, I mean, we've seen in history not only vaccine companies, but companies that have put out all sorts of medication who've cooked the books, you know, on their studies, and sure, they've been released to the public. They've caused injury. They've caused disease. They've caused death. They've had to pay, you know, millions of dollars in settlements. And yet they keep going in business, and for some reason the press never makes a big deal out of this.
Yeah, and let's go back also to what you mentioned earlier about the vaccine industry. Most people don't know this, that the vaccine manufacturers have legal immunity against vaccine injuries. And the CDC, if the CDC recommends a vaccine for its childhood schedule, that act grants legal immunity to the vaccine manufacturers. They cannot be sued for vaccine injury, except there's two conditions basically in which that wouldn't apply, where you could sue a vaccine manufacturer in the civil courts, you know, but that would be like, for example, if there was somebody did something in the manufacturing process that they shouldn't have done, you know, like, whoops, we used the wrong ingredient, you know, something like that, or if they, you know, had mislabeled, you know, used it for a mislabeling violation. So, you know, they claimed something on the label that proved not to be true or something like this. Those are two kind of limited cases where, according to my understanding, it would still be possible in most cases for most, you know, for that, if you're injured from a vaccine, you can't sue the manufacturers. Instead, the government in 1986 passed a law that granted legal immunity to the vaccine manufacturers. Why was that? Well, if you go back to what was happening in the 1980s, the law was passed in 1986. What was happening at the time, the climate was that the vaccine industry was really in trouble because there were so many vaccine injury lawsuits, particularly TP vaccine, diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis vaccine, the whole cell pertussis vaccine that they used to use in the U.S., and so the industry was really it was going out of business. I mean, there were vaccine manufacturers that did go out of business, and it was threatening public policy. And so to ensure the vaccine supply, you know, in accordance with public policy, the government, you know, granted this legal immunity to the vaccine manufacturers. There's a situation we have where, on one hand, the government, you know, assures people, we hear it constantly, vaccines are safe and effective, safe and effective. Vaccines are safe and effective. Vaccines are safe and effective. We hear that constantly. It's a mantra. And yet, here's the same government that is assuring us of this has granted legal immunity to the vaccine manufacturers that was upheld in 2011 by the Supreme Court on the grounds that certain injuries from vaccines are, quote, unavoidable, and that wording that they used was something like product defects are not a basis for liability when it comes to vaccines, you know, the special case of vaccines. That basically put an end to any possible route of suing the vaccine manufacturers, because that's actually what, you know, originally, as the law was originally written, was that, okay, if you disagreed with the judgment of, you know, you mentioned the vaccine court, that's what was kind of building off of you earlier, you mentioned the vaccine court. So instead of, you know, the regular court systems, the government, in lieu of that, set up, you know, what you were referring to as the vaccine court, which is really just a it's not really a court. I mean, there's no discovery. You know, there's no jury. but, you know, it's a special not a tribunal, but a special master's procedure, administrative procedure, proceedings. And basically what it is, you know, if you have a certain injury that is listed on a table that the Department of Health and Human Services maintains, then you're automatically awarded compensation. For certain injuries that aren't listed on that table, it's up to the claimant to prove causality. In other words, to prove that, you know, that, that there really is no other explanation for the injury other than, you know, the vaccination. And incidentally, there's been cases of children with autism winning financial compensation, you know, their families are being awarded under this compensation system, which is funded by a tax, an excise tax on every vaccine dose that's purchased in the country. So that the financial burden for vaccine injuries is shifted away from the pharmaceutical companies and onto the taxpayers by this means. One specific case was Hannah Poling, who received nine vaccine doses in a single doctor's visit and ended up regressing into autism. Her family was awarded compensation, and the CDC director at the time, Julie Gerberding, acknowledged that, you know, it was in certain children who have genetic susceptibility. In this case, Hannah Poling had a mitochondrial disorder. The mitochondria, the cells, they produce the energy in the cell. So she had a disorder that, you know, she, for example, she might not have been able to, you know, like detox her cells as well as, you know, other children. So mm-hmm. There's genetic susceptibility involved. And this is another issue that the media will never touch, that there are certain children who are genetically susceptible, or susceptible not just based on their genes, but, you know, based on their environment, their diet, their gut microbiome. How healthy is their gut? You know, these other issues involved, and it's not as though you can just say, well, vaccines are safe and effective for everyone all the time. You have to look at it on a case by case basis, and you have to look at it on the individual level to assess, you know, the cost, the risk benefit analysis has to be done on that level, on an individual level. In this particular case, the CDC director acknowledged that, you know, certain children, vaccines can cause brain inflammation, which can lead to brain damage, which in her words can lead to this, symptoms of autism. Well, we know this; it's acknowledged. So whenever we hear that, you know, science has proven that vaccines don't cause autism, well, where are the studies? Where are the studies that have actually considered the question of genetic susceptibility? And it's true; there's all kinds of studies out there showing that, that didn't find vaccines to be associated with autism. That's true. But you know, the studies are only good as the assumptions, you know, underlying them. And an example of, to return to the flu shot, an example of that is, it was brought up again by the Cochrane Collaboration, and pointed out that none of the studies in their systematic review actually looked at the question of whether the fundamental assumptions the CDC was making in making its recommendation were actually true. In other words, you know, did the vaccine actually reduce complications from influenza? Did it reduce transmission of the disease? And did it reduce mortality among the elderly? And none of those studies actually even looked at those questions. So this is just, you know, another reflection of the situation that prevails in the country today, where what the science says and what the policy is, there's just a serious disconnect. And you know, the clearest example of that is the legal immunity that's given to vaccine.
So talk a little more about the, I mean, everybody wants to know about the childhood, you know, the infant vaccines, the vaccines. Yeah, I don't even know what the schedule is. I don't have children. When I was a kid, I was born overseas, so I have one of those holes in my arm where they, you know, give you that vaccination before you come back into the country, that they stuck you with and everything. And then I would assume I had like the normal thing back then, which probably was like one shot. But, you know, what have you learned about what the schedules are? I mean, the efficacy of what these kids are getting.
Yeah, and that's something you'd have, you know, people talk about vaccine. The media tends to talk about vaccines as just kind of this, you know, conglomerate. You know, vaccines are safe. You know, well, which vaccines? Are all vaccines safe? Was the diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis vaccine safe? Because we don't use it in this country anymore, and there's a reason for that. You know, because the whole cell pertussis vaccine was associated with all kinds of, you know, injuries. And that's why they stopped using it in this country. They still use it overseas. But, you know, but what does science say about the effectiveness of the DTP vaccine? Well, interestingly, you know, although the assumption behind every vaccine that the CDC puts on its schedule is that it's going to reduce mortality from the target diseases, you know, that they never actually look at that question before they recommend these things. So, you know, in hindsight, you know, after the fact, scientists have actually bothered to look at that question with regards to the DTP vaccine, and they looked at it in Africa. And every single study to date that's looked at the question of the effect on mortality of the DTP vaccine has found that it kills more children from other causes than it protects from the target diseases.
Now, explain that.
Yes, that requires an explanation. What do I mean why it kills more children from other causes? Well, one thing we know about vaccines, contrary to, for example, I have this you know, CDC information sheet that I picked up at our pediatrician's office, and right on there the CDC says that, you know, trying to explain what a vaccine is and how it works, and they say that vaccines confer the same kind of immunity as natural infection, only without having to go through the symptoms. That's a lie. CDC knows that's a lie. Vaccines don't confer the same kind of immunity as natural infection. And so there's a number of different hypotheses about why it might be that the DTP vaccine is having this effect, that these kids that get the shot are dying from other diseases. I'm sure it actually, you know, there's a reduced, they're dying less from, pertussis, they're dying less from diphtheria, but they're dying from these other causes. And we see this also with the influenza vaccine. For example, we know that unlike natural infection, which confers immunity across let me back up a little bit. So the vaccine, it, you know, contains only about five, I think it's five. Well, there's typically three or four strains, I think, of influenza virus influenza vaccines. That, you know, so three or four strains that the vaccine is designed to prevent the disease of. However, there are many, many other kinds of virus that the vaccine does not protect against. And there are all kinds of viruses that cause influenza-like symptoms. There's over 200 known viruses that cause influenza-like illness, what they call it. You know, there's a broad term, influenza-like illness. There's over 200 known viruses that cause what doctors commonly call the flu. So the idea that, you know, the vaccine is going to protect you from the flu when only it is a fraction of viruses that actually cause flu symptoms, you know, are targeted by the vaccine, you know, is absurd right off the bat. And so what we find is, you know, whereas the natural infection you would receive, if you were just infected with the flu naturally, your body would stimulate both the antibody response, you know, the vaccine is intended to create. So vaccines are intended to create antibodies. It's to stimulate your immune system to create antibodies to go attack the virus. But there's also what's called cell-mediated immunity, which is, you know, different kind. Your body has different mechanisms to fight pathogens like viruses and bacteria, and antibodies are only one part of that immunity. And so, natural immunity confers this, you know, more robust cell-mediated immunity, whereas the vaccine just stimulates the antibody response at the opportunity cost of lost cell-mediated immunity. So, you know, if your listeners who understand economics probably know what an opportunity cost is, but it's the same thing in this case. So by preventing that natural infection, and long-term weakening the immune system, so that then you get the flu vaccine and you actually become more susceptible to illness from other viruses. You know, this studies have shown this to be the case, that I think it was the pandemic H3N2 vaccine, or I think it was recipients who received the seasonal influenza vaccine were more susceptible to the pandemic H3N2 virus. There's studies showing that the more frequently you receive the influenza vaccine annually, like the more you do it year after year, the less effective it is. Interestingly, one study showed that, you know, the recipients who had received the vaccine in prior years, the vaccine was effective for those individuals compared to individuals who are only vaccinated, you know, in the current flu season. Interestingly, they didn't look at the question of, well, how does that compare to people who didn't receive the vaccine at all, which is a curious oversight. You'd think they would want to look at that question as well. But, you know, there's indications from other studies that we know what the answer would be, that getting the influenza vaccine can actually increase your risk of illness by the mechanisms I described. Another mechanism is called original antigenic sin. This is the idea that when your immune system is first kind of met with a challenge from an influenza virus, you know, your cells have part of the cell-mediated immunity is memory cells that, you know, they can, once they've learned how to adapt and meet the challenge and put up, you know, a defense against it, that it remembers how to, your body remembers how to do that. So the next time that you're infected with a strain of influenza, your body puts up a response to it. But in the case of, you know, original antigenic sin refers to this idea that your body remembers. So if you have built an immunity to a specific strain, the next time you're met with a different strain, the body puts up a response as though it was responding to the originally infecting strain. So again, there's this kind of opportunity cost where, you know, if you were being infected for the first time, it would put up a response that would be more effective, whereas it's putting up a response based on its memory of a slightly different strain, so that it's not as effective against this particular strain. And so there's this idea of original antigenic sin as related to vaccine conferred immunity as opposed to natural infection. So this is what explains why, you know, why every study that's been done shows that kids die more from other causes as a result of DTP vaccination than they do from, you know, than the numbers who benefit from not getting pertussis or diphtheria or tetanus. So, you know, there's all these kinds of issues. You know, there's issues related to the ingredients in vaccines, like aluminum, which is a known neurotoxin. And the line we all hear is that this, you know, this is the amounts that are in the vaccines are safe and that you don't have to worry about it. It just passes through the body. And we know this is false. We know studies show that the aluminum for vaccine persists in the body. In fact, it's carried to the brain and passes the blood-brain barrier. It accumulates in people's brains.
Why do they put aluminum? What is the purpose of the aluminum in there?
Great question.
In these vaccines.
So they use aluminum it's called an adjuvant. So an adjuvant is something that they put in the vaccine specifically to stimulate a stronger immune response. So basically, see, this is another thing going back to the whole FDA vaccine approval process. The clinical trials that are done to get licensure for vaccines, they don't have to actually show that the vaccines provide immunity. They don't actually have to show that. All they have to show is that the vaccine can stimulate an antibody response considered to be quote unquote protective. Trouble with that is that an antibody response is not a good indicator of immunity. An antibody response is neither always necessary nor sufficient for immunity to be created. So that right there is a major flaw in the way vaccines are studied to get down to the market. So what the vaccine manufacturers do is, in certain vaccines, more of the vaccines that are to protect against bacteria, like pertussis, the DTP vaccine, the DTAP vaccine, the acellular pertussis vaccine that we now use in the U.S., they include aluminum as an adjuvant to stimulate a stronger antibody response. So that when they submit their studies to the FDA, the FDA can look at those and say, oh, wow, this vaccine really produced a lot of antibodies in all these subjects. So I guess they have immunity. So I guess it works. And that's how it goes. But of course, the aluminum is not harmless. The aluminum is a known neurotoxin. It kills brain cells. Although we hear in the media that that we don't need to worry about it, but studies show that it accumulates in the brain. A very recent study just showed they actually looked at the brains of autistic children, and they found just alarmingly high levels of aluminum in their brains. The lead, I don't know if he was the lead author, but one of the researchers on that study was Chris Exley, who is one of the world's leading researchers on aluminum toxicity, and that study changed his mind about the relationship between vaccines and autism, and he sees that a plausible case to be made that vaccines can contribute to autism. Another way in which vaccines could possibly contribute to autism is inflammation, maternal inflammation. So I read in the media things like, you should get your flu shot because, pregnant women should get their flu shot because, if they get the flu, they could have a fever and inflammation can damage the fetus and harm the fetus, which is true. But the thing is what are you doing when you get a vaccine, when you get the flu shot? Well, you're trading a possible hypothetical, inflammation with a guaranteed inflammation. You're guaranteeing that the mother is going to have inflammation by giving her the flu shot. You're guaranteeing that because that's what a vaccine does. Okay. It's insane, the arguments that are used. There's certain inflammatory cytokines that vaccines produce that are associated. There are studies showing that these inflammatory cytokines, particularly one called IL-6, are associated with autism. It can begin in the womb, there's other environmental factors, in terms of autism. There's mercury amalgams, dental, the fillings that are in people's teeth. There's just all kinds of environmental toxins that children are exposed to these days. And it's frightening. And the thing is we keep hearing that nobody knows. I mean, you look at the rates of diseases and chronic illnesses, 46% of children today chronically ill. How is that acceptable? 46% of ill children today are chronically ill. It's insane. And what do we hear? Oh, well, we don't know what's causing it, but it can't be vaccines. Come on. Let's have a serious discussion. Let's look at this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not just our health that's at risk. It's our liberty. It's our freedom. You know, and I know your libertarian members of your audience can appreciate, hopefully, although I feel the libertarian community has really failed on this issue. But you know, this is an issue of fundamental human rights and the right to informed consent. Yeah. And public policy represents an all-out assault, not just on our health, but on our liberty. And that's why it's so important. I mean, regardless of what your own personal, you know, anyone's personal choices about vaccines or their personal, you know, risk-benefit analysis that you might do, in some cases you might make, you know, you might feel that, hey, you know, hey, I'm going overseas and there's a lot of this certain disease in this country I'm going to, and it might be a good idea for me to get vaccinated. Well, you know, that risk-benefit analysis has to be done on an individual basis. But, you know, regardless of one's personal choice, this is an issue that needs to be taken seriously. And the lies and the deceptions that the public is just inundated with on a daily basis from the government and from the media, I mean, it's just enough is enough. Like, let's look at these things. Why is it off limits to look at the role of aluminum in vaccines in chronic illnesses, autoimmune diseases? I mean, we know vaccines are associated with autoimmunity. The swine flu vaccine was associated with Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is basically, it resembles polio. I mean, it's a paralytic disease. In fact, there was one study in the medical literature I read that actually looked at FDR and determined that he didn't actually have polio. He probably had GBS or Guillain-Barré syndrome. So, you know, it's a crippling disease, and the flu vaccine was associated with it. Other seasonal flu vaccines have been associated with things like narcolepsy or seizures in Australia. They had to stop their vaccine campaign one season, mid-season, because so many children were having seizures after getting the shot. I mean, you know, we just hear this mantra over and over again that vaccines are proven safe and effective, but the reality is that vaccines have proven unsafe and ineffective over and over and over again throughout their history. DTP vaccine, look at the pertussis vaccine today. Let's look at that for a second. Well, we're told, you know, these outbreaks of whooping cough that we're seeing, it's the fault of parents who choose not to vaccinate their kids, and they're breaking herd immunity by not vaccinating their kids, and that's why we're seeing these outbreaks of whooping cough or pertussis. Well, that's just not serious. The reality is that the pertussis vaccine, number one, has caused antigenic drift of the bacteria so that today the dominant strain in circulation in the U.S. is vaccine resistant because it doesn't contain an antigen that is included as an ingredient in the vaccine. It's called protactin. It's a protactin deficient bacteria, whereas, you know, protactin is one of the antigenic components of the vaccine, so it's designed to produce an antibody response to that antigenic component. But the bacteria has evolved as a result of mass vaccination to not have that, so it's vaccine resistant. Not only that, but the CDC has acknowledged that vaccinated individuals are at greater risk of being infected with protectin-deficient strains of pertussis. I mean, and then a CDC-funded study has confirmed that conclusion, that vaccinated individuals are at greater risk of being infected with the strain of pertussis that now dominates in circulation in the U.S. today. And yet every time there's a whooping cough outbreak, we hear about how it's the fault of parents who aren't vaccinating. And it's just crazy what's going on in this country, and with the disparity between, you know, what the government and media are telling us and what the science is telling us. And, you know, it's just well past time that we sit down and have a serious discussion about the science. And the thing is, you know, the pro-vaxxers, to borrow their own terminology, you know, their derogatory anti-vaxxer label, well, the pro-vaxxers don't want to have this discussion. And they just throw up all kinds of flack. You know, anytime somebody tries to have a serious discussion about this, they just throw up all kinds of flack and, you know, and just avoid, you know, with straw man arguments or, you know, just personal attacks. Well, you're a conspiracy theorist. You're a loon. You know, you must believe that the moon landing was faked and blah, blah, blah. And they don't, it's not serious. And, it's just, the one thing I want people listening to this to understand is that, you know, don't take my word for this. You know, go and look at these studies. You know, like when I do research when I write, like if you read my flu vaccine report, click those links and go look at the studies that I'm citing to support everything I'm saying and go read them for yourself. Don't take my word for it. Look at what the science says. Go to PubMed.gov and research this stuff. I mean, and the problem is, you know, obviously not everyone has time to do research projects on issues like this. But my point is that, you know, you don't have to take what I'm saying, you know, at face value. Look at what I'm saying. I'm giving you the studies. Go look and see and see for yourself that what I'm saying is true, that what the science says is completely different from what we're told it says.
Well, I think one number that you brought up there, if it's a fact that 46% of children are, you know, developing ongoing, you know, health issues, I mean, as long as you can prove that that's spread out over all ethnic and socioeconomic, and I mean, there can only be, I mean, what other explanation is there? There can only be one thing that you can narrow it down to if you spread it out over, you know, rich, poor, black, white, you know, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, and I mean, there are different susceptibilities depending on subpopulation, but, you know, just generally speaking, it's you know, almost half of children. It's over 40%. And, you know, that's one of the things. There are subpopulations who are more vulnerable. And this, for example, you know, going back again to the issue of genetic susceptibility, there are kids who, you know, might have mitochondrial disorders, or they might have gut dysfunction or some other, you know, this is the thing, you know, vaccines were developed, they were invented before scientists really knew anything about how the immune system works. And even today, we're really still only just beginning to understand, you know, with the discovery of the microbiome and how the bacteria in your gut. I mean, we used to have this view of, it's funny, my son was watching a cartoon the other day. It was the magic school bus, and it was, you know, like the magic school bus shrinks and goes inside this body, and the teacher in a magic school bus is explaining how, you know, bacteria are things that get in your body and cause you to be sick. and I'm just thinking, like, actually, you know, we need the bacteria that live in our bodies. I mean, we have this symbiotic relationship with them. And the whole paradigm of vaccination is that there's these germs out there that we have to just, you know, fight against. And reality is that we were designed to live with these things. I mean, you can't escape vaccines and bacteria. Part of our, you know, I think it's 8% of our own DNA is viral in origin. We have more bacterial cells in our body than we do human cells. Our immune system depends on bacteria for its functioning. They bacteria produce essential, you know, amino acids that our bodies can't produce.
That's why after you,
we need the bacteria in our gut to help us produce those from the food we eat.
Yeah, that's why after most people take antibiotics, they're sick and their gut is so bad.
Because it's indiscriminatory. I mean, it just wipes out your gut bacteria that we need for health. And this is the reason why, you know, doctors giving out antibiotics like candy, where it's like, you know, every little, when I was in Taiwan for, it's worse over there. I was in Taiwan for a number of years and doctors would just give out antibiotics like candy for every little sniffle. It was even worse than it is in the U.S. You know, they don't do any lab tests to confirm that it's even bacterial. You know, kids get earaches, and you know, they don't even know whether it could be a virus, it could be bacteria. They don't know. They just, well, you take some antibiotics. It's a serious problem. And the other thing is, you know, there are so many, like you were saying, you know, with this epidemic increase in chronic illnesses and autoimmune diseases and other diseases, you know, there's this kind of claim that still lingers that, well, this genetic, you know, like autism, oh, it's genetic. Well, I'm sorry, it's not genetic. Sure, there's genetic elements, there's a genetic component, but the reality is that, you know, the obvious truth is that this is environmental. We are being poisoned. The population, we're being poisoned. There are environmental toxins in a whole huge range of environmental toxins, from the chemicals they use to fireproof, you know, the mattresses in your furniture, to, you know, the mercury from coal plants that we're told we can't eat fish. We can't eat fish because there's too much mercury. You have to limit your fish intake because of the mercury that's in fish. But somehow injecting mercury into children is safe, because, you know, although most childhood vaccines have they use mercury in vaccines as a preservative, and they used to use it in more vaccines, in childhood vaccines, and they did remove it from most childhood vaccines. After, the thing is they were using it because the CDC through the 80s and 90s was adding more and more mercury-containing shots to their childhood schedule. Nobody in the government ever bothered to ask the question of what the effect would be of the cumulative doses of mercury that kids were receiving from this preservative that they put in the vaccines. Nobody bothered to look at that. They never did studies to determine even what amounts of mercury kids would be exposed to. And so when it became publicly known that the amounts of mercury, you know, the cumulative amount of mercury that children were exposed to from the CDC's routine schedule was greatly in excess of the EPA's own safety limits, you know, that's the reason it was removed. That's, you know, they kind of were like, well, we're sure it doesn't cause autism, but we're going to, you know, play it safe and just remove it anyways, because, you know, it's greatly, kids were receiving far in excess of what the government itself said was safe. You know, and they still use it in flu shots. They still use thimerosal. Thimerosal is the actual, you know, the brand name of the, or the product name of the preservative that they use. And it's 50%, 49%, almost half mercury by weight. And you'll hear this. You'll hear, you know, whenever you hear about the mercury in vaccines, you'll hear said that, oh, well, the form of mercury in vaccines, you know, passes harmlessly through the body. It's not the same as the form of mercury you get from fish. Well, that's true. It's not the same form. The form of mercury you get from fish is called methyl mercury. And the form that you know, when thimerosal is metabolized and broken down, the form of the mercury that it is broken down into is ethyl mercury. And the claim that ethyl mercury just passes harmlessly through the body is based on, you know, a study that looked at, you know, blood content of mercury. And what they found was that, you know, there was less ethyl mercury in the blood than, you know, from like vaccine exposure, than methyl mercury from, you know, whatever exposure you would have methyl mercury from, such as fish. So, you know, blood ethyl mercury basically clears from the blood faster. So therefore, you know, we don't need to worry as much about it. Well, the question that they weren't asking was, well, if it's not in the blood anymore, where did it go? They didn't ask that question. Well, now scientists have asked that question, and they've determined that ethyl mercury actually accumulates more in the brain than methyl mercury, and degrades into inorganic mercury, which is, there's different forms of mercury. Methyl mercury and ethyl mercury are both organic forms because they attach themselves to carbon molecules. Yeah. But it becomes inorganic mercury in the brain, which can't then be removed from the brain. Whereas methyl mercury also can pass the blood-brain barrier and get in the brain. Methyl mercury can be removed from the brain. Whereas once the ethyl mercury gets in the brain and becomes inorganic mercury, it can't be removed from the brain. It stays there. It accumulates.
Yeah, I was thinking that when you were saying that, when you were talking, I was saying, you know, okay, there's mercury in fish, but that's going to be something natural and the mercury that they're putting in, the mercury they're going to put in the vaccine is going to be something, I mean, unless they base it on, you know, something in nature, it's going to be something made in a lab, you know, it'll be something made in a lab.
Yeah, and that's another talking point that people have about vaccines. It's like, oh, you know, you'll get more, you know, mercury from breast milk than from vaccines, or, you know, you ingest more aluminum from your environment than you, you know, you would get in a shot. Well, the thing is, you know, you have something called an innate immune system, and it's designed to protect you from environmental toxins like
right.
aluminum, mercury. And so, you know, when you ingest aluminum, you know, your the gut lining, you know, from your nasal tract all the way through your intestines, you know, that's designed to protect you from that aluminum. Whereas what do vaccines do? Vaccines are designed to deliberately bypass the body's innate immune system and inject that directly into the tissue or
right,
of
right, yeah.
body.
That yeah, exactly.
So this comparison that, oh, well, you know, you ingest more aluminum than you know than you would get from a vaccine. It's and the other thing is it doesn't consider the synergistic toxicity. So when you put, you know, the toxicity of a certain dose of aluminum might be one thing, and the toxicity of a certain dose of mercury might be another thing. But when you combine the two together, the toxicity is synergistic, so that, you know, that it's the combined toxicity is, you know, beyond just the sum total of the individual toxicity. So there's these synergistic effects, and these synergistic effects have to be, you know, considered in light of all of the environmental toxins that children are exposed to today, not just children. We all, not just children,
right.
We're all exposed to. You know, so from the fluoride they put in the water, you know, which is environmental waste. You know, if a dentist removes a mercury amalgam from someone's mouth. You know, the American Dental Association says that mercury amalgams are safe. Well, as soon as a dentist removes one of those things, it has to be treated as toxic waste. So,
yeah.
You know, there's like an invisible line beyond, you know, where inside your mouth it's not toxic waste, but you remove it from there and suddenly it's toxic waste. No, it's toxic. You know, those amalgams emit mercury vapor. You know, there's just so many environmental toxins that you have to consider the synergistic effects of all of them combined. And it's not just like, oh, well, we're going to look at just the, you know, the effects of this one, you know, environmental toxin or this one vaccine ingredient. No, you have to look at the totality of it. You know, and the only real way to be able to do that is would be prospective randomized placebo-controlled studies, you know, those kinds of robust, you know, gold standard studies would need to be done.
Well, here's a question I have. Okay, you said that they realized that there was too much mercury, and so they reduced the amount of mercury that was in there. What is, if they're using it as preservative, what is keeping them, maybe you can answer this, because you know, and you can give me your opinion, what's keeping them from finding a more natural preservative? Something that, you know, something that's biological, something that's in nature, something that's in us, something that they can develop that they know will not be harmful.
Well, yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, it's actually, I've read some studies showing, you know, talking about how mercury is actually a really horrible preservative. So, you know, I don't really know the answer to that question. What's preventing? I suppose it's the same reason, you know, that when I read studies that are critical of vaccines, that, you know, find problems with them, that find that they're not effective, that find that they're not safe, they always have to be kind of framed from this assumption that, you know, they always start out with, you know, this comment, something like, you know, well, vaccines have proven to be one of the greatest health interventions of mankind, but, you know, and then they go into the study. And it's like this cognitive dissonance. It's like you can't, it's like, again, the influenza vaccine is a great example. You hear CDC say things like, you know, the flu shot is your best protection against the flu. Well, show me the studies that have compared people who got the flu shot with people who exercise, eat right, get healthy amounts of sunshine, supplement vitamin D in the winter, supplement vitamin C if they have to, if they're not getting it from their diets. You know, people who live a healthy lifestyle and eat a nutritious diet, why is it that the flu comes around in the winter? It's vitamin D deficiency. It's literally a disease. It's not that it goes away in the summer. The flu virus still circulates in summertime. People just don't get sick from it.
Well, you know what's crazy is I've never had a flu shot in my life. Up until about 8-9 years ago, probably maybe 10 years ago, I never really concentrated on eating properly, never concentrated on vitamins. And yeah, I got into meditation, which helps to relieve stress. And I've, ever since I changed basically the way I eat, added some supplements, and meditated, I haven't been sick. Now, a couple weeks ago, I started getting the sniffles, and for about 24 hours, I had a burning in my throat. But I was over it in like 24 or 36 hours, where I know people who had the same thing, it turned into a chest cold, and they were down for a week. So, yeah, that whole thing about, taking care of yourself, watching what you eat. I try to, do juice every day. I do vitamin D every day, even all day, every day all year. And it really does help. Now, like I said, I've never had a flu shot in my life. I used to get sick, but as soon as I started taking care of myself, I don't get sick anymore.
Yeah, I mean, we know, and the immune system depends on vitamin C for so many of its functions. And we know that it supports, that we need it for our immune function. And so this idea that, well, the best, so that, that claim that the best protection is to get your flu shot. It's like, how come they don't even talk about vitamin D? How come the CDC doesn't talk about it? How come they don't inform the public? Well, make sure you're getting, that you're supplementing if you're, so make sure that you're sufficient during the winter months. I mean, this idea that, well, just go get your shot, you'll be okay. I mean, it's just this whole disconnect between, it's also an arrogance. There's just this incredible arrogance of the scientific community that, this idea that somehow we evolved imperfectly, that nature didn't design us with a properly functioning immune system, that all of us from day one of our lives with the hepatitis B vaccine given on day one, that we all required this medical intervention somehow for our immune systems to function. Well,
and
it's insane.
And you said you pointed out in your article, quoting the study that Carol quoted, was if they look and they're able to really nail down a virus and a vaccine for it, it really only affects 1 in 33 people. If they don't have it close, and correct me if I'm wrong, if the vaccine and the actual virus aren't even close, it may be 1 in 100.
Correct. Yeah. So those are the numbers. So Carol cited the 1 in 33 figure. He said so that, there's one person benefits from the shot for every 33 people that are vaccinated, and that's a great public health achievement, even though it's not ideal. He acknowledged that this year's flu vaccine was particularly ineffective, and to quote from his own admission. But he's saying that even in years like this one, where the flu vaccine is admittedly very ineffective, it still confers this great public health benefit. But one of the things was he was cherry picking, because that 1 in 30, it's called a number needed to number needed to treat, NNT. And so he was doing the 1 to 33 NNT that he's citing. But that was specifically in cases where, in seasons where the vaccine was well matched. In other words, that the strains of the virus that they included in that season's flu shot. So let me go back and actually explain that real quick, because unlike most vaccines, the flu vaccine is different every single year. They do a different formulation every single year because the influenza viruses, they just shift so much. There's so much antigenic shift and drift so that it changes, it evolves, and it mutates, or it becomes, the dominant strain is different every year. So the World Health Organization actually does is, they have this global surveillance, and they basically just try to guess based on the surveillance, like what's going to be the most prevalent strain, what are the most prevalent strains going to be this year. And then it issues recommendations to countries, and then, you know, countries can decide what they want to do. But, you know, this, for example, the CDC would decide, you know, what strains would be in the U.S. formulations. And so they just kind of guess, like, what they think that the you know, most common strains are going to be for that season, and they often choose wrong. And so, you know, in years where the vaccine was well matched to the circulating strains, you know, the Cochrane Review found that, you know, the NNT was 1 to 33. But in years where it isn't, you know, in the average year, most years, when it's not well matched, they found that, you know, 100 people had to be vaccinated just for one person to be able to see the benefit. And that conclusion, they cautioned, had to be considered in light of the industry's influence on the studies and how, you know, a lot of those were actually industry studies. And, you know, we know studies have shown that industry-funded studies are biased, that they're more likely to produce results favoring the manufacturer's products, which, you know, which is, you know, not surprising that would be the finding of studies that have looked at that question. So, again, it's just, there's just such a disconnect between reality and what we're told, and we're supposed to just go obediently line up and get our shots. But, you know, I really urge people to really consider that, you know, for themselves. Is it right for you personally? You can't, there's just this idea that, you know, it's that vaccines are, you know, the solution for everyone, you know. Again, it just overlooks, public policy treats vaccination as a one-size-fits-all solution when we know, and what that essentially does is that it lays certain children on the sacrificial altar. Because there are certain children who are genetically susceptible to vaccine injury. And so we don't know who they are. That's the problem. The science hasn't developed to the point where we're able to identify them, to be able to say, well, that's a contraindication. You know, for example, you have a history of family history of autoimmune disease. That's a contraindication to this aluminum-containing vaccine. You know, we haven't, the science hasn't gotten to that point where, you know, we have contraindications like that. Oh, well, you have a mitochondrial disorder, so you shouldn't get this vaccine. You know, there aren't these kind of recommendations. It's just like a one-size-fits-all policy. You know, and the contraindications they do list are very, you know, marginal and narrow. You know, to get vaccine exemptions, typically, you know, it's kind of more determined by the state than the federal government. But, you know, typically to get in the states that do have medical, exemptions, they typically are so narrowly defined, and it's you know, just really unreasonable where, you know, a parent might have a really reasonable concern about vaccinating their child on the basis of, you know, family history of autism, for example, or, you know, some autoimmune disease or mitochondrial dysfunction, gut dysfunction, something like this, and really have serious concerns about, you know, that increasing their child's risk of having an injury from vaccination. And the government just is completely unreceptive to that and completely closed-minded to that. And it really is coercive to threaten parents, you know, with the denial of public education on the grounds that they're not just following up, you know, getting in line and obediently getting their kids vaccinated, you know, strictly according to the CDC schedule. Even parents who just get all the vaccine on the schedule but just prefer to space them out more. You know, even parents who choose to do that, they're like, you're ridiculed, you know, as though that was crazy. Like, what's wrong with them? Why would they want to, you know, put their kids through more, you know, more shots than necessary? They could just get it done over at one time, but you're going to space it out, you know, prolong the agony for them, you know, have them. I mean, like, they're ridiculed for making that decision, which is just instinctual, you know, like, gosh, maybe all these things at once just is not a good idea. You know, and it's really just the nature of the conversation needs to change. You know, the nature of the public discourse on this issue really needs to change.
Yeah, the one thing that you said was, you know, the phrase you said, one size fits all. It reminds me so much. I mean, it's just everything government. You had, you know, Michelle Obama's thing was diet, you know, diet. What foods were people eating? Well, I mean, I can tell you from personal experience, the things that she had on her pyramid or whatever, you know, graph of eating, if I eat that stuff, I gain weight and I get depressed. There are certain kinds of foods that I eat that make me feel that make me feel better and, you know, keep weight off. And, you know, as you get older, that, you know, that can be an issue depending on body type and things like that, you know, genetics. And, it, you know, it's the same thing. When you think about it, it really is insane that they can come up with this concoction to stick into, to inject into babies and say that it's one size fit all, that it's going to be fine for everybody across the board, yet they have this panel back there and not in case, but when things eventually go wrong so that they can make settlements. I mean, that should warn anybody to start asking, you know, to at least start asking questions, especially before your child's born and, you know, they want to turn he or her into a pincushion.
Yep. Yeah, and you know, there's never been studies. There's never been a study examining let me back up. The Washington Post had an article that I responded to, and they in their Washington Post article they claimed that every vaccine before it's added to the CDC schedule is studied when given in conjunction with every other vaccine on the schedule. That is an absolute lie. There has never been such a study. And I actually, I wrote a response to that, and I quoted from the Institute of Medicine, you know, acknowledging that studies examining the safety of the entire CDC schedule, in other words, at the effect of every vaccine, not only studied individually or with one or two other vaccines, but given in combination, the entire schedule, there's never been such a study. And I actually contacted the author of that that Washington Post piece, and I confronted her about that, and I pointed out that she informed me that the Washington Post had received my my letters, you know, pointing out, requesting a correction, acknowledged that she had looked at the IOM study, and then she accused me of cherry picking from it. I provided her the quotes from the IOM study saying that there has never been a study, you know, of looking at the entire vaccine schedule, you know, directly opposite of what she had written. Yeah. And she just refused to do anything. And I said, you have a responsibility, you know, apart from the Washington Post's process and their editorial process, you have a responsibility as a journalist to tell the truth. And she hung up on me. She refused. She refused to correct her false information, and those studies have never been done.
That's insane, man. I mean, it just goes to show that, you know, I talk to people all the time about, and I ask them questions like, why do you believe what you read in a newspaper? Why do you believe what you see on TV? And when you look at, you confronted someone who wrote an article with facts, and I'm not, and it's not like, oh, you did the exact opposite. You didn't cherry pick. You picked out the one thing in the article that just basically destroys everything she just said.
Yeah,
and I mean, I don't, you know, it
man, and it's the fact that people like that in the media get, and the media gets away with that. They get away with just blatantly lying. And the thing is the whole purpose of that article was to persuade parents that they have nothing to fear of getting their kids vaccinated. That was the whole purpose of the article.
Unbelievable.
To persuade parents to go out and get your kids vaccinated. You don't have to worry about anything. Every single vaccine on the childhood schedule has been studied when given in combination with every other vaccine on the schedule. Blatant lie.
Unbelievable, man.
The same thing with the Aaron Carroll article on the influenza vaccine. The whole purpose of his article was to say you have to follow the CDC's recommendation. Go out and get your flu shot every year.
They're just cheerleaders.
It's like these articles. It's not journalism. It's like these articles are written by they might as well be written by the vaccine manufacturers themselves. It's propaganda. It's just blatant propaganda, and we're just bombarded with it. Just all of this deception we're just bombarded with on a daily basis, and it's like the media won't even scratch the surface. I mean, when was the last time you read an article that talked about the concerns about vaccines causing autoimmunity?
Yeah.
Or, you know, concerns about the aluminum in vaccines.
It's a given now that vaccines are perfectly fine. I saw a lady who was talking about her twins. She had twins, and she said they were the most happy-go-lucky kids, and they were just fun-loving. You know, they were enjoying a great life. And, you know, at around 2, they went in for, you know, to get on schedule. And from that day forward, they were completely different.
Yeah, and there's just so many of these stories. There's so many parents.
And they find excuses for it. Or they say that they're lying. No, the kids weren't like that before. Who's paying you? You know, what anti-vaccination group is paying you to, you know, to lie about your kids?
Right, that's the
thing. It's a religion. It's a religion.
Exactly. It is a religion. It's the vaccine religion. And I actually have an article that I titled something about, I don't remember what it was, but I specifically titled it has something to do with the vaccine religion. Because it is. It's dogma. It's not science. It's religion. It's a faith. And, you know, how do we address this issue where that's what we're up against? Where if you speak against public policy, you've committed heresy.
It's the religion of the state, man.
It's the
most dangerous religion in the world.
It's an extension of the state religion, this vaccine religion. And because, you know, and this, you look at the reason why they say, oh, you know, well, those, you know, like, it's not as though, you know, most of the time, I mean, the Washington Post article that claimed that those kinds of studies exist was kind of an exception because, I mean, most of the time you see, you know, pro-vaxxers are like, well, they acknowledge that those studies have never been done, but they say, well, we can't do those kinds of studies. That would be unethical.
Yeah.
I mean, the reason they say it would be unethical to do, like, randomized, like, placebo-controlled studies of vaccine, you know, kids. You know, the CDC's recommended schedule according to the schedule, and kids who never receive any vaccines, they said the reason that we can't do those kinds of studies, vaccinated versus unvaccinated, because the kids in the placebo group would be deprived of all the benefits of the vaccine. So, I mean, classic begging the question, you know, I mean, assuming, you know, the very proposition to be proven is true, you know, petitio principi fallacy. You know, you can't, you know, the whole idea in that test would determine whether that's true. And so they say it can't be. Now, interestingly, you know, when I was doing my research for this flu vaccine report I've got that's coming out part two soon, you know, I was looking at some of the studies, you know, like I mentioned earlier, you know, the Cochrane collaboration, for example, was saying that studies are urgently required, you know, far from New York Times saying that, you know, the harms are almost non-existent. Actually, what that same study said was that studies are urgently required safety, especially for kids under 2, because those studies haven't been done.
Talk about cherry picking.
Exactly. You know, and that, you know, the Cochrane collaboration pointed that out, and emphasize the need for randomized placebo-controlled studies. And another study, I forget which journal it was published in, kind of arrived at the same conclusion that, you know, the studies are really badly needed. However, you know, there's a problem with doing those studies because it's already standard of care. You know, so the policy came before the science. We're told the science is settled, but no, the policy was there before the science was done. And now they say, well, they can't do the science because it's already public policy. And this one study I'm referring to actually, you know, showing that it's not about ethical concerns at all. It's just about politics. Their recommendation was, well, that it's possible to do studies ethically in other countries where universal vaccination isn't recommended. So, you know, what's the criteria there for whether the study is ethical or not. It's got nothing to do with, you know, the unvaccinated cohort being deprived of the benefits of the vaccine. It's got everything to do with the fact that it's public policy. That's the only obstacle to doing those kinds of studies.
Well, I want to start wrapping this up. What would you like to say to, to just encourage people to, start looking into this, start asking questions, point them to some documentation. And I'm going to ask you, I'll email you after this so that you can give me links that I can put in the show notes. So, how'd you like to wrap this up?
Yeah, I would just strongly encourage everyone to really question things. You know, question the underlying assumption behind the very theory of vaccination, that, that there's things called viruses and bacteria out there that, we need to be, terribly afraid of, and they cause disease. And this whole idea that the way to prevent disease is to, inject ourselves with bits of these pathogens to stimulate an antibody response, so that the next time we're infected, the body knows how to fight it. The whole thing, just consider that, the assumption underlying that is that, we didn't evolve naturally to have a functioning, immune system that already knows, that already has everything it needs to be able to, keep us. I mean, hundreds of thousands of years of evolution with an immune system, it works. The thing is we just have to give it what it needs to work. Mm. We just have to give our immune systems what our immune systems don't need vaccines to work. That's the bottom line. Immunity can be gained. I mean, look at the dramatic.
You're cutting in and out.
Oh, how are you? Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. Don't know what that was. Look at the dramatic reductions in morbidity and mortality of numerous diseases right across the board, prior to even being introduced. I mean, how was that accomplished? It was accomplished through advancements in standard of living, in better nutrition, and better knowledge of health and sanitation and hygiene, and all these things had nothing to do with vaccination. Just be willing to question your fundamental assumptions. And the biggest thing is it's hard, I think, as a parent today, especially for parents, who have children, and they're it's a tough decision, what to do, because the idea that, you might do something to your child that could end up causing harm rather than, doing good, that's a terrifying thought. And, parents have to deal with that question, and, either way, whatever you choose to do, it could go well. It could go badly, but just consider the risk benefit analysis on an individual level for yourself, for your family, for your children, and don't just take the CDC's recommendation at face value as everyone should do this, because they don't consider the consequences for individuals, and the differences in individuals, and the differences in immune responses in individuals. Or reactions to the vaccines based on individual, environmental factors and genetic factors. So just really think for yourselves and do your own research, and don't just trust what the CDC says. Don't just trust, they approved it, it must be safe. My doctor's recommending it, so therefore it must be good. The CDC actually, I should end with this note, has put out that there was an Institute of Medicine workshop, and the CDC presented, they did a presentation about, it's basically how can we make sure that we sell more flu vaccines. And they were talking about how they needed, they had to inspire the necessary fear. So they should, they should report every, they had advice to make sure that we're describing every flu season as deadly and, all these, frightening sounding terms. And they, one of the problems they were running into was that, young, for example, healthy adults aren't really at risk for complications from flu. It's elderly people and infants are obviously at greater risk, but healthy adults aren't really a risk population for flu. And the problem is, you know, most adults don't really view the flu as something to be terribly afraid of. And kind of in connection with that kind of problem that they were trying to deal with was, there's the fact that there's so much information available to them. I mean, you can go online and you can go to PubMed.gov and just search the medical literature for yourself. And you can research the medical literature right there. It's a government website. In addition to, just a proliferation of blogs and health websites and things that, that educate people about their health. And so people are becoming more adept at kind of educating themselves. And this presentation described that as a problem. And they said that health literacy was a growing problem in this country, because more and more people are kind of educating themselves and making their own choices, rather than just like blindly following CDC recommendations. And the CDC views that as a problem. The CDC views that as a problem if you go and research for yourself.
Jeez.
That's different from the conclusion that they want you to come to.
Jeez.
So that's the situation. And so just think for yourselves, do your own research. That's what I would, just kind of end on that note for listeners. And be skeptical and question and, really trust your gut, I think, on a lot of these things, because there's a lot of parental instinct, especially for parents, you listen to that inner voice, just listen to it and take that into account.
Go ahead and plug and website, books. I've read, I'm almost done with Obstacle to Peace. And then after that, I'm going to do the Ron Paul Krugman book. And yeah, I think next time I have you on, we can talk economics, because that could be,
Ron it up. Yeah. Awesome. Go to www.jeremyrhammond.com. That's where you'll find all my archives of writings, articles, blog posts. Sign up for my newsletter there. You'll see opt-in forms on the site. Go there. If you're reading one of my vaccine articles, you'll see an opt-in form there. You'll also get a free report. You can download on the FDA vaccine approval process, some of the things I talked about earlier. It's all, all the references and everything are in that report. So go ahead and download that. Get on my mailing list. Make sure you stay updated with my work on vaccines. You can also, once you're on my mailing list, you can determine what kind of information you want to get from me, because, like I said, I do write about a wide variety of topics, from U.S. foreign policy and vaccines, as you just mentioned, economics. So you can kind of pick and choose what you want to get from me, but go ahead and get on my newsletter. Also, go to www.foreignpolicyjournal.com. This is another website of mine, my publication. I publish not only my own work, but the work of other contributors. Also, I'm on Facebook, Twitter. You can find me. Just go to my website. You can find my my social media accounts. I'm on Twitter at just Jeremy R. Hammond. So, definitely check out my work and definitely get on my newsletter at jeremyrhammond.com.
I'll make the prediction right now that I think this episode is going to get as many downloads as the previous episode that you were on. I think a lot of people are going to want to hear this. Because most of the time when you hear any conversations about vaccines, it is on social media, and it is two people yelling at each other. So to have someone who can actually sit down, calmly say what the research, what the research is, what the research has told them, and to be able to present, what's out there. What is easily verified? I think people are going to really enjoy the. I think people are going to enjoy this one, and I think we're going to get a lot. We're going to get a lot of comments about this one.
Well, I hope it was educational thank you for hosting this discussion.
Oh,
it's very important.
No problem, man. I really appreciate it. It's always a pleasure. And till the next time.
Awesome. Let's do it again.
I want to thank you for tuning in to episode 92 of the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. I want to thank Jeremy for coming on today. I want to remind you about my book, Freedom Through Memedom, The 31-Day Guide to Waking Up to Liberty, on Amazon. I look forward to my next podcast. It'll be coming out sometime next week. Take care. Have a great weekend. Bye.